All right, welcome back to Bitcoin Study Sessions. I'm Lucas. I am joined by Mr. Grant Reichert, Esquire, who shares the same professional designation as W. Aaron Daniel, Esquire, the author of Dispute Resolution Without the State. This is an academic work printed in the Satoshi Papers by Natalie Smolinski. I'm pretty sure I'm smart enough to figure out how to put a link to this, and I hope that you read along. That is our goal with these talks, is that we elevate discussion around Bitcoin and around the topics that Bitcoin touches, which, as we're finding out as we further pursue this topic, is basically everything. But today is an interesting one, because today goes into how does enforcement work from a judicial perspective? In the court of law, what we're trying to do is resolve disputes. And essentially, that comes down to power and control, because without the ability to coerce someone into a resolution, then your courts have no power. But what happens when we live in a world where the money cannot be controlled by any individual power? How does that affect dispute resolution? And where could we possibly go? How could this perhaps improve our legal system and make it better and more fair, and possibly cheaper for all those involved? So, as always, to kick it off, Mr. Grant Reichert, Esquire, please give us a beautiful summary of what we've read today, and then let's have a talk about it.
Thanks, Lucas. And I like Lucas gave a really kind of, 60,000 foot aerial view. That's an excellent broad context summary of what we read today. And I'm going to give a bit more of a granular summary. And our purpose in doing this, again, is when we talk about something, Lucas and I, we want to make sure we're talking about what the author wrote, fairly discussing their point. So I'm going to try to get those arguments out on the table, and then Lucas and I are going to, kind of try to parse them apart a bit and then add our own perspective. So as Lucas mentioned, this essay in the Satoshi Papers is Dispute Resolution Without the State by W. Aaron Daniel. He's a practicing attorney with a Florida Bar Certified Appellate Specialist designation, years of practice. Founded the Open Source Justice Foundation, a nonprofit dedicated to supporting development of open source tools and software. Founder of Bitcoin Grove, a community accelerator and co-working space in Miami. Many other things, including he has an app called Resolver now, which I think we might discuss just a bit towards the end. This essay is going to cover another use case for Bitcoin, which is always exciting to see. And it's going to cover, too, something near and dear to my heart, lawyers built on Bitcoin, which is something I want to see more and more different professional designations building on Bitcoin from their own respective skill sets. So as Lucas mentioned, or I guess to step back a bit further. So one problem that Bitcoin solves is universal permissionless access to a stable financial system. We know that large swaths of the world population live in countries with rapidly inflated currency. Large swaths of the world's population are unbanked. They have no access to bank accounts. Bitcoin fixes that, provides everybody permissionless access to a stable financial system. Just have to have a cell phone internet connection. What other problem can Bitcoin fix? Another problem, access to justice. More than 4 billion people live outside the protection of the law without access to justice. They can't get into the courthouse doors to a fair, neutral, and accessible court system. 54% of the people globally live in authoritarian countries where kind of ultimately justice is at the whim of people who control the system. And even in the U.S., there's large and disparate access to the courthouse. So this article proposes a new type of dispute resolution system which can be built on Bitcoin to remedy some of those access issues. First, the author kind of gives some background generally, and Lucas mentioned this. Let's talk about courts, the court system. It seems like courts have to be state-run because they rely on the monopoly of coercion that the state has to actually enforce the judgments produced by the courts. Civil court systems produce judgments that declare the rights and obligations of parties, which are different than other types of kind of judgments, decisions in society because they're enforceable. You can get the police to come over and make the other party pay what they owe you that the court has said that they owe you. Within our court system or our current judicial system, or rather kind of outside of it, on the peripheries of it, we also have private, non-coercion-based options for resolving disputes. These are kind of known as alternative dispute resolution mechanisms, or ADR. You can get the decision in ADR from an arbitrator saying that party A should pay party B, but then if that party refuses to comply with that ADR resolution, you then have to go to court to get the coercive power of the state to make them pay. If a private system then is going to be a viable substitute for that state-run court, it's going to need to solve this problem. How can judgments be enforced in the absence of the state monopoly of force, coercion, etc.? So the author, Daniel, has two things an alternative dispute resolution system, an ADR system, is going to need to be truly independent of the state. One is control of the flow of funds. Two is processes that closely reflect the norms of a community in which the ADR system is embedded. So first, control of the funds, that's going to allow enforcement of the judgment because then you can just direct the funds to the winning party without having to get the police to come in, the troops to come in, whoever, and make them hand over the money. The system just automatically diverts funds to the winning party. Second, processes that reflect the norms of the community, that's going to confer kind of the perception of legitimacy and fairness on the ADR system, which is necessary because you actually have to get people to use it. You can design the most beautiful, intricate ADR system, but if nobody believes it's fair, just, or legitimate, nobody's going to use it. Here, then, I'm going to read this. The thesis, broadly writ, of Daniel in his own words. This essay proposes a new class of ODR, online dispute resolution systems, that enable any community to resolve its disputes through control over the flow of funds. Bitcoin dispute resolution, or BDR, is the new class he proposes. This new class of ODR, online dispute resolution, uses the Bitcoin network, the world's most decentralized communication protocol for the transfer of value, by anchoring dispute resolution systems in Bitcoin's interoperable, programmable, and global network. Self-executing monetary judgments can be rendered that do not rely on the courts for enforcement. The essay then has, it's kind of a two-part structure. First part examines existing ODR systems, and then the second part examines why the Bitcoin network is particularly well-suited to be an ODR, online dispute resolution system, and then gives two specific formulations of the way that a BDR could be constructed. Existing ODR systems, the author gives two broad categories for these, off-chain and on-chain. Off-chain, don't use crypto, on-chain, do. Off-chain, we get, as examples from the author, very interesting. I mean, if you're interested in examining the way that disputes resolved around the world in alternative ways, very interesting. We get eBay in India, MJERGA in Afghanistan, the Benoam system in Israel, and the Prospera Arbitration Center system in Honduras. So eBay in India. eBay generally has control of funds, which is the first criteria for private enforcement. And in India, the eBay there also has a community court system built into it where the seller can dispute reviews, jurors are selected by an algorithm, review evidence from both parties, and then disperse the funds automatically or whatever to the winning party. So eBay is one example of an ODR. Another example, the MJERGA in Afghanistan. The mobile JERGA, MJERGA, was a proposed system in 2010. It was observed at the time that Taliban courts were perceived as, more people use the Taliban courts than the national court systems for reasons of perceptions of legitimacy and efficiency of the court system. So people were like, we need to get people away from those courts. They developed this mobile JERGA idea. The JERGA is a traditional system where a bunch of elders got together and kind of talked about a resolution for a dispute and then said the resolution and the people followed it. And then the mobile JERGA essentially is a way to make this process online. You can do it remotely. The elders convene remotely. People upload their evidence, etc. This wasn't actually put into place. It was a proposal, but Daniel notes that it shows how ODR systems can resolve not just disputes in e-commerce like with eBay, but like real-world substantive disputes about what happened. Then the Benoam in Israel. This is incredibly interesting. The Benoam alternative or online dispute resolution system, ODR system, is kind of a in Israel for small fender bender style property disputes. There's this ODR between insurance companies, kind of like a private court system specific to a particular industry. This uses experts to decide cases, and if the experts do not have their cases overturned on appeal, they are sent more cases. The control of funds stays within the system. All these insurance providers basically maintain the system together. All the funds are kept internally with them and then paid out to the winning insurers at the end of the month. Daniel notes that this system shows that you can build a whole non-coercive but functional ODR system if the parties consent to it and all come together to enter into it based on consent. Last, for the non-chain ODR examples, is the Prospera Arbitration Center. Prospera, if you haven't heard of it, is a semi-autonomous city in Honduras, part of the Free Cities Movement. The Prospera Arbitration Center is their manner of arbitration where the citizens, the residents of Prospera, consent to this ODR system, like in Venom, and then they agree they're going to abide by the judgment, and that makes it functional. So these are all samples of off-chain. The author, Daniel, then gives two examples of on-chain systems, BISC and Skleros. BISC is a peer-to-peer Bitcoin for fiat exchange operated by a DAO, decentralized autonomous organization, resolves disputes that the traders have about their trades, essentially. He talks about how this functions. You can have lots of ways to construct things like this. This uses a two-of-two multi-sig, so the parties put their funds in this containment vessel that they both have to sign to get out, and then that allows for the control of funds that then makes a judgment enforceable without having to have an authority to enforce it. Kleros is an example on Ethereum used by freelance workers to resolve disputes with an interesting crowdsourced decision-making mechanism in which jurors are chosen that try to, they decide not based on any body of law, but they predict what the other jurors are most likely to decide, essentially. It's kind of a shelling point, as Daniel notes, for jurors picking the winning solution and then getting rewarded for that. And Kleros really shows, Daniel says, the use of smart contracts to achieve automatic enforcement that can substitute for the force of law if people voluntarily enter into the system. So we have eBay, Venom, BISC, and Kleros. These show that ODR systems that are private and don't rely on the state can function. The MJERGA and the Prospera Arbitration Center show that you could actually resolve real-world disputes through ODR systems, not just like e-commerce, eBay limited disputes, if the parties consent and buy into the system. That's the end of kind of the first part of the essay, the author's survey of ODR systems. The second part, again, is what role can Bitcoin play in a potential ODR? But before I do that, Lucas, I want to get your perspective and just see if that makes sense, like what ODR systems are and how they could be important and game-changing if they were more widely used.
Yeah. When I read through this, what came to me was the idea that truth is just simply what we agree on. And so we're trying to find truth. And what ODRs allow for is effectively a crowdsourcing of that truth-seeking model. The Kleros one is really interesting because I think it's almost like a prediction market. It's almost like Polymarket, where instead of like what you believe, what you're trying to do is just predict what other people are going to settle upon.
Because if the juror picks, if you get paid as a juror, if you are on the majority juror position, so you want to kind of try to coordinate what are the majority of other jurors going to pick.
Yes.
Yeah. So that's a really fascinating approach because it compensates jurors for being on the popular side. So they have, in effect, they have skin in the game, right? If you're on the losing side, then you actually lose, like, because you're staking tokens, right? Yeah. So it would be like, you know, it'd be like, I'm going to go be a juror at a regular trial in a courthouse, and I walk in and they're like, all right, put up $1,000.
Yeah.
And you can't talk to any of the other jurors and take in the evidence. And then cast your vote, guilty or not guilty, or however you want to, you know, do it. And then if there's 12 people and you're the one that votes and the 11 vote the other way, then your $1,000 goes, I think it goes to the DAO, right? Or it goes to, maybe it goes to feed the payments to the other jurors. But I find that interesting because You know, I've been a juror before, and it's ridiculous. Like, you bring in these people that have no idea what's going on, and they're very easily persuaded one way or another. And then you've got two people that are professional persuaders who are attempting to get you to see their side.
But you began saying that the juror system is supposed to a dispute resolution system is supposed to find the truth, but the Kleros is not designed to find the truth. It's explicitly not designed to, don't decide what's true. Maybe you want to find the true thing because you think other jurors are going to pick the true outcome, but it's not really the criterion you're deciding.
Final popular, I guess. Yeah. That's just a really fascinating, one.
Well, I'll just say Daniel's perspective on that. He does say that that method, that Schelling point method of juror decision making, he thinks that it's maybe, you know, it's not good in the sense that it's interesting, maybe it works, but it makes it tougher to confer legitimacy and fairness, neutrality from an external point of view. If you realize that jurors are deciding on that basis, maybe you're less likely to go into that system because you don't think you're going to be the popular party.
Exactly. Yeah. And so you could see it maybe working for certain instances, but for anyone who is like, oh, I have a complex case to make that is going to require, people to really think, it probably wouldn't work. Let's define for people who may not know Schelling point. So a Schelling point would be basically where actors in an environment that have other actors, they're making decisions not based upon what they think will happen, or not based upon what they believe, but based upon what they think other actors will do.
The more general idea of a Schelling point is, how do you coordinate multiple actors without direct communication between the parties? So say that you and I are going to go meet in New York City, but we realize when we get there that we didn't say where in New York we're going to meet. So we'd have to find this. We'd have to, like, the Schelling points, like, is it the Empire State Building, the Statue of Liberty? Is it Grand Central Station? We'd like think of the places, where's Lucas most likely? So we try to coordinate between parties with no communication possible. And so you're trying to, kind of guess what the other party's thinking.
I would be at the Carnegie Deli, which I think still exists, but I'm not sure, eating a very large pastrami sandwich.
That narrows it down.
Yep. Yeah, good. So we've got these online dispute resolution platforms. BISC is an interesting one. The Binuum, kind of, let's talk a little bit about that, I think, because that's one that, when reading through this, it seemed like it's the one that's working the best because it has really narrowed the scope of what they do, where this is a dispute resolution platform that only addresses very narrow cases, which would be disputes between insurance providers and claimants regarding very specific types of claims on automobiles in accidents. So one of the things that is constantly bandied about when I was at the network state and being around all these founders and things like what Balaji would say and other people that came in and talked to us was, do things that don't scale. And that's really where you want to start, where everybody's always like, well, how do I build this platform that manages everything in the world? When instead, what you really need to do is find out if what you do provides value. And so I wonder, is that a good example of doing things that don't scale, where it's like, yeah, we can resolve whether or not I dinged your door with my door. But we're probably not going to be able to move into the realm of being maybe like a DUI or a reckless driving claim or something like that. How do we take that narrow view and then apply it to a wider subset of disagreements? Or are we always going to have this? Are we always going to need to have this legacy system in order to dispute those more complex?
I mean, if you want to expand on the Benoism system, I think you begin by abstracting its elements and seeing why generally it functions. Is it because it's insurance? No, maybe not. Maybe what's more general about it that allows it to succeed is it has the same recurring parties, the insurance providers. It has parties that are often on one side of dispute, then being on the other, plaintiff and defendant. So nobody's trying to establish precedent that's going to be favorable to them in the future because they don't know what side of the game they're going to be on when they're playing it next time. You do have, again, the recurring type of dispute. It doesn't have to be insurance. There are lots of recurring types of disputes within the legal realm that you could design a court around. But you're going to, again, need to have recurring parties and industry that is able to coordinate between the parties. So it is going to be limited in scope on what you can coordinate on. And there are going to be some types of, you know, even an ADR system or an ODR system, rather, online dispute resolution system that tries to regulate real world conduct outside of like e-commerce. You know, there's so many types of disputes we can get into and types of resolutions. It begins to be tough to think of something that's going to, in the manner of the Benoism system, be able to encapsulate all forms of legal dispute, I guess. But I think we're going to talk about in a second the BDR, Bitcoin Dispute Resolution, and we can kind of think then, will this handle the range of real-world disputes? Because the author does have a suggestion. So we'll move on to the second part of the essay. Again, this part is what role can Bitcoin play? We've talked about these ODR systems. Can we construct one then with Bitcoin? So Bitcoin meets two conditions for a successful ODR system. Remember, control of the flow of funds, community embedment, essentially consistency with community norms are the two conditions. So control of the flow of funds in order to enforce judgment. Bitcoin is a stable, independent, programmable financial system, which includes its own internal transaction rails. If all the parties are using it, you can agree in advance and allow the funds to be dispersed by some sort of smart contract using the Bitcoin system. You're all operating within the same financial system. And there's also decentralized verification with nodes and other measures of decentralization, so there's less third-party risk when you trust the system. The second part, community buy-in. ODR systems that are embedded in a community can get people to actually perceive the system as fair and therefore use it. Bitcoin, permissionless, has communities across the world. The author lists various countries in which there are nascent or established Bitcoin communities. And to quote the author, the Bitcoin network embodies the principle that justice should be accessible to all, not only those with bank accounts, credit cards, or state-issued identification. The different Bitcoin communities around the world then can adapt, can use Bitcoin as the control of funds mechanism, and then design rules around the ODR system they want to use that is consistent with that the norms of that society. The author gives two examples of BDR systems that illustrate this. The first is a local community BDR, Bitcoin Dispute Resolution Court model. Again, Bitcoin is programmable, so you can have second layers on top of it. And a lot of times we casually throw around second layer. So the author gives a good example of what that means, though. An example of a second layer, SMTP for email, which integrates into the TCP/IP base internet protocol. So email is a second layer on top of the internet. In the same way, Bitcoin can have second layers on top of it that give it more functionality. Fediment is one example of a way that Bitcoin can be elaborated upon. It's a community banking model for Bitcoin in which people hold their money together, their Bitcoin together in this eMint that then issues them a cash style token that they use amongst themselves, transfers instantly, doesn't have to settle on the underlying Bitcoin protocol. And so it allows Bitcoin's functionality amongst a trusted community that's willing to participate in this structure. To quote the author, in short, Fediment enables communities to create what might be called their own financial operating system. This allows for control of funds, one necessity for an ODR. And then the community can then designate a dispute resolution system according to their needs and values. Lucas and I talked about different ways that jurors can be picked and decide, like the Schelling Point model or something different. And then the judgments will be automatically enforced by the people who consent to enter into that system, thereby substituting consent for the coercion of the state. The other example, the second one, is a prosper. A prosper-like city could implement this. The parties in the community agree in advance to participate in the BDR system. They deposit and maintain the minimum amount of Bitcoin in that community fediment model. Upon taking residence in that community, when the dispute arises, funds are already locked in. Both parties submit evidence to that fediment community app to some BDR panel. A decision is issued and the Bitcoin transfers automatically. So that's the first example, like a community model, a community local court option. In addition to that local court option model using fediment, where a community makes their own dispute system, Daniel gives another example of BDR for already existing online communities. The example he gives is the open source software development community, which uses sometimes a bounty model where people who want some code offer a bounty for the production of it. Whoever does the code, they can claim the bounty, but then that depends on the bounty offerer actually agreeing to pay out that code based on the code they get. BDR could automate bounties, Daniel says. You can have a panel of third-party reviewers that are selected as jurors to adjudicate whether a bounty was met. And if so, that could trigger the release of Bitcoin from an escrow that was previously funded by the person offering the bounty. That type of escrow can be done through tools. Daniel mentions a couple, discrete log contracts in the Fediment protocol or Bitcoin miniscript. Not really familiar with the discrete log contracts specifically. He also notes that a bounty bulletin board, in which the bounties are noted, could be maintained through the decentralized Nostr data protocol. So those are the two models. One is that local community court model on Fediment, and the other one is given in the context of software seeking, like offering bounties for code. What do you think of those two types of potential BDR systems?
So we had this at the network state, and this was something that you can immediately see the moral hazard, which is it's called the EARN program. And the network school posts these bounties for primarily it's like media stuff.
So the network state wants to get something done for the network state. So they offer a bounty for whoever in the network state does that task.
And it's not even just specifically for the network state. Like I remember one of them, my friend Juba submitted one. There was a bounty to create a 59-second vertical video that chronicled Nayib Bukele's rise to power in El Salvador, right? So it's not specifically that. But this is kind of in line with the open source software idea, which is that the reason why people create open source software, even though they don't financially benefit from the immediate use of that software, is that they and everyone else benefit down the line. The best case example of this is Bitcoin, where it was created, it was put into the world without holding back coins, without pre-mining, without investors, without cashing out, because it made it better. You know, this is why, if you're running a household and you're in charge of the food, then it's a benefit for you to purchase healthy food. Even though you're not the only one consuming it, it makes everyone healthier around you. If you're in a neighborhood and you take care of your lawn and you take care of your garden, then it not just benefits you, but it also benefits the neighborhood because it makes it better for everyone. So these are these certain sacrifices that people make. But back to the idea, so you post this bounty under the EARN program and you could immediately see that there is a moral hazard, which is that there could be 10,000 submissions. And if you wanted to, there's actually nothing to stop you from just taking the best one and using it and not compensating the user for it.
Yeah.
And so Daniel does a really good job of outlining that moral hazard and proposing a solution to it. using this kind of layer two that you can build on top of it, where you have this adjudication layer that is basically community sourced and community enforced through software. One thing that Claro's, I think, does really well, they're the ones that place it in a, they place the disputed funds into a time-locked multi-signature smart contract, which is basically just like saying, hey, you're suing me for $10,000. I'm going to have to put $10,000 into an envelope and hand it to this guy. And this guy is not going to hand it to anybody until a dispute has been resolved, and until there is a decision. I think that's it really is needed, because Daniels does a very good job of outlining, and even though I think he does it quickly, but the system that we live in right now, it offers justice, but only through power and control. And you can't escape that system. You're just part of it, and it can reach out and touch you. But these systems, they offer dispute resolution, and all they ask for in return is consent. And consent meaning control over the flow of funds, in order to reward the winner, or the truth seeker, I guess.
And also a consent, like, to maintain, maybe you have to maintain a bond, essentially, amount of funds in an account, so that if you become party to a dispute, that is already locked in. So you have to consent in advance to be part of a court system. And then, yeah, you're already.
Yeah, he gives that example of, like, if you're posting a bounty, you know, the person posting the bounty has to put up the funds, but the person applying for the bounty has to put up an application fee as well. And so everybody has some skin in the game. And you can, I guess, again, like, skin in the game ensures that people act morally, more than anything.
Yeah, you mentioned the network state, Lucas, and I was curious. You mentioned the EARN program, sort of bounty system to get things done. It sounds like the Prospera dispute resolution, the Prospera Arbitration Center, was more broad in resolving disputes among the residents. I mean, do you even know, like, is the network state subject to Malaysian law as far as people resolving disputes, or is it semi-autonomous in the same way where the network state could have its own internal law and arbitration center that applies that law?
So as far as I understand, and I think we covered this one time when I was there, not you and I, but when I was there, I do believe that you are subject to Malaysian law and the exclusions that are put in place for the special economic zone where Forest City is located, which is the fake island that it sits on. So no, there is no sandboxing, really, of autonomy that Prospera has. And I do think that's, I personally think that's vital. If you're trying to create a society that you need to be able to set your rules, and do what you want within that boundary. There's a guy there, James of Arc, who is a charter city guy. So charter cities are different than network states. Charter cities simply hope to exist within existing cities, but have their own prerogatives. They have their own laws, have their own rules. And I think about the importance of that. I heard somebody once define, like, what a nation is, as the only jobs that a nation has is to defend property rights and defend borders. And if you view a nation or a country in that way, then the charter city model is one that really, I think, gets it right in terms of, look, we're going to have our own disputes. We're going to have our own court system. We're going to have our own laws. We're going to have our own taxes. We need to be able to enforce that among our community. The current model of the network state, I don't believe has any sort of laws.
You could even if there was Malaysian law generally applied, you could have a second layer of network state law on top, which would just be essentially the power of Balaji to evict people that, or the network state higher ups to evict people who don't abide by certain community norms. And then you could have an arbitration center that resolves, people consent that, okay, I'm part of the network state, I consent. If there's dispute that arises with me and somebody else, it goes through this arbitration mechanism, and I automatically consent that I will abide by the result of it. Yeah. In instances like that, there still might be within the United States, you then maybe have to, if the person doesn't want, they say they're going to abide by it, but then they don't, you might still have to go to the court system to get an enforceable judgment because you don't have like control of the funds. Unless, again, a person bought into the system, maybe they have to post a bunch of money, leave it in the system. And then if they don't abide by the result of the arbitration, if they go to the court and they forfeit all the funds, I mean, that would be one enforcement mechanism to get people to abide by the judgment. Even if the judgment regulates their behavior, which is not being coerced, you know, you could make them forfeit all the funds that they've posted if they don't act accordingly to the judgment. So I can see it.
That is something that exists where, you know, like you sign a contract and that contract basically outlines certain behaviors and stuff like that. If you break those, then they boot you out. It's a fairly informal process, but ultimately it's not really enforceable until there's, you know, the power and control of Malaysian law behind it.
Yeah. But if you locked in money into a, you know, some sort of smart contract, even if, you know, the ultimate eviction was according to Malaysian law, you could make people suffer if they sought that remedy going to the court because they've already forfeited all the money they posted. So even if, you know, they might just abide by the result because they don't want to lose their money that they posted in the system. And that's the way that control of funds, as the author notes, is an essential way that you can get, I think, judgments maybe that regulate conduct beyond merely the disposition of the funds themselves. Another part that I thought was interesting. So we recently read Sal Pineda's take on Bitcoin's potential role in transitional justice, which are situations where countries are transitioning away of after a situation of mass atrocity, genocide, civil war, an extended authoritarian rule. The country is then unstable. It realizes there was past injustice. The country both needs to process that past injustice, but also stable itself to move forward. So the field of transitional justice has arisen to enable like a framework for people to apply when if a country's in that situation. Sal talked about how Bitcoin used as a way to help reconstitute a neutral financial system. He also noted, this is the part that's relevant, that court systems in transitional setting are often compromised because like there's partisans of one side of the past dispute. Maybe the people against whom genocide was committed now control the court system, so they're heavy-handedly going after everybody. Daniel, though, he's offering a way we could say apply a BDR in a transitional society setting. The BDR, Bitcoin Dispute Resolution System, is a stable court system completely independent of the state in a sense. I mean, you're still going to have to select independent jurors somehow, which could be difficult, but at least it offers somewhat of an enforcement framework, perhaps, if someone wanted to try to design one in a transitional setting that would be more resistant to the ways in which transitional courts are compromised. I mean, one would need to sit down and do the math and find a creative way to select jurors, keep enough information anonymous so they render fair verdicts, and then weed out jurors in the future if their types of decision-making aren't in accord with, you know, or exhibit certain trends of bias or something. Yeah.
This is a massive problem that presents a massive opportunity for resolution. I talked about this in one of my seminars on status games. And there's like three ways to gain status. One is to effectively be a bully and to take from others. One is to effectively be a victim and oblige others. And the third is to be meritocratic and to earn it. And the instance that we see like in El Salvador, I remember when we were living up in Wenatchee, you know, you had a lot of client when you were doing immigration law that had come from El Salvador. And some of them did not have this rosy picture of what Nayib Bukele is like that many of us see, because it was such a sweeping thing that occurred, where there is no other way to do it. Like when you're living under a authoritarian regime, what you're doing is you're living under a bully. And the only way that you can take out a bully is to be a bigger bully. And so you replace one thing with another, even if it is better intentioned, then you still end up with the bully problem. And so you can see how this naturally is going to create hellacious bias when you go to the court system, because the people who are now running the courts are, and this, we've seen this in America now, where we saw the Biden administration weaponize the justice system, and now we're seeing the Trump administration do the same thing. All right. It's just whoever's in power.
I will say that Bitcoin, I mean, philosophically, right down to its foundations, is designed around the ethos that maybe it doesn't take a bigger bully. Takes the creation, a bottom-up, like Bitcoin, like Satoshi creates a bottom-up solution to this banking, the chancellor's on the brink, situation. So maybe you can, cypherpunks write code. That's their solution. It's not to join some political party and try to be the bigger bully. It's to create solutions outside and independent of the state that, based on our consent, we can substitute for the mechanisms of the state. It's exactly what BDR is, an online dispute resolution generally. How can we take consent of the governed and make that the foundation instead of top-down coercion, which generally is the project of the Satoshi papers, is to get back to the consent of the governed, the ideals of our founders, that Bitcoin can represent a more general remedy to tyranny than a bigger tyrant.
Yeah. Last night I read, I was reading in the Our Tribal Future book, and there was a line in there that really struck me, which is that we need to remember that we are citizens, not subjects. And I think that even in America, and maybe particularly in America, we've somewhat forgotten that, that we are citizens, that we are living in a country that exists because we consent for it to exist, not because we are under the umbrella of Powell, and therefore subject to whatever comes down. You bring up, I think, the most important point about Bitcoin and about change just in general, not with regard to monetary policy, but just any sort of change. And beneficial change, it seems to me, can only come from the ground up. It can only come bottoms up. When we try to do things top down, then we end up with all the second and third order consequences that we never think about. And of course, if it comes top down, then it comes from the position of power, and the position of power is always going to do things and set laws and regulations and codes and conduct that allows it to stay in power. Bottoms up Bitcoin dispute resolution is something that, once the mechanisms are in place, and it seems like they are falling into place, that there are options through Fediment and through online smart contracts that allow people to lock up funds in a time dispersed manner, and to only disperse those funds if they both agree and consent to the ruling. We have these tools and we have these mechanisms, and they are being slowly adopted, and they're being adopted in areas where people are most likely to be negatively affected by what the top-down system is. Because you mentioned in your initial summary, 4 billion people don't have access to justice, but there's also the other 4 billion people, the justice that they have access to is a two-tiered system, at least two-tiered. The United States is a perfect example of, if you have money, you can avoid prison, you can avoid certain things. If you don't, then you're subject to the whims
Yeah, no, and that's, I mean, that wasn't, I mentioned that because Daniel puts that front and center too. And I want to read his concluding paragraphs because they tie back to that notion that Bitcoin banks the unbanked as a permissionless, decentralized global financial system. I don't know if you want to say courts the uncourted, but it does something like that. It can do something like that, right? If you have a BDR system, it can also potentially solve an access to justice problem. So I'll just read these couple paragraphs because it does an excellent job summarizing this paper. The global, interoperable, permissionless nature of the Bitcoin network now enables any community, regardless of its location or size, to create an ODR, online dispute resolution system that uses programmable money to generate self-executing judgments. These systems can only obtain control over user funds with the consent of the disputants. This means that state-backed coercion can be removed from the dispute resolution process entirely. The Bitcoin network and its native asset provide democratic tools for communities to establish the rule of law, irrespective of the quality, efficacy, or fairness of any particular state-run court. Transforming ODR into BDR will advance and normalize the practice of dispute resolution without the state, expanding access to justice for all of humanity. Yeah.
I like it.
I do too, man. And like, never accuse Bitcoiners of simply number go up when you see the applications that are being built and the promise that the protocol offers in so many different ways.
Yeah.
This is the, you know, when people initially get into Bitcoin, I remember hearing Andreas Antonopoulos talk about when he first discovered Bitcoin. I think he said he spent the next 3 months or 4 or 5 or 6 in a just a what he described as a fugue state, where he is realizing as he looks at the world in front of him with new eyes, what are the consequences of money that is decentralized, money that is finite, like money that cannot be taken, it can only be given. And these are the Bitcoin solves this type of questions that are worth asking, because if it is simply number go up, then it's degeneracy, and you may as well put your money into some sort of moon coin, Dogecoin, whatever. But if you are looking for something that is greater, if you're looking for something that really can affect humanity at a base level, and put us in a mode of cooperation instead of competition, but competing against ourselves in order to cooperate at a higher level, I think it is beautiful to consider these avenues. You wanted to talk, I want to change subjects a little bit. You wanted to bring up the Resolve app. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
I don't know enough about it to discuss it in depth. I just wanted to know, and this does bring up a question I had or something I want to mention. So the Resolve app is something that Daniels has. He's an entrepreneur working with others, put out an app. It deals with something like risk management for insurers by allowing them to denominate in Bitcoin. My understanding is something like, if you're insuring Bitcoin, but you're not also like holding Bitcoin, but you're holding fiat to reimburse people, that's not a good solution because people lose their Bitcoin.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. You're insuring something, an asset that's going way up, and you're holding an asset that's going down or something like that. But I don't want to, it's, so I've heard, just, he has a podcast about it. Look it up. It's very interesting. But that's like, you know, this is an article written by an attorney, a practicing attorney. There, Bitcoin is a technology that has, as we're seeing, a vast number of social applications, like dispute resolution. That's something we need because of the social nature of. So Bitcoin is, again, a technology that has a bunch of social applications because we're social animals, and we're exploring the ways that Bitcoin's unique aspects, its immutability, decentralization, permissionlessness, is interacting with the ways that humans organize ourselves in various ways through our financial interactions, court interactions, et cetera. This is an article by an attorney. And I'm really curious, like, what other like attorneys are building on Bitcoin, thinking about building on Bitcoin, or what other ways can attorneys, people with knowledge of the legal systems, knowledge of our social arrangements through law, use this new technology to offer decentralized solutions. Benoim is another way that attorneys built an ODR resolution system in an area of law. What can Bitcoin now do, not just for dispute resolution, like Resolver is maybe a way that it's changing insurance risk management. On Twitter, there's, you know, I wanted to find more attorneys. There's one called Bitcoin Laws by Julian Ferrer-Farrar. And that's a great, if you want to look for like a summary of change, the changing nature of legal, of laws around Bitcoin around the United States, summary of like pending house bills, et cetera. I mean, it's just an excellent account to follow. Zach Shapiro, it gives, like another thing that attorneys do is give commentary on legal cases that affect Bitcoin. I was remember reading a ton of his stuff on Tornado Cash situation with Roman Storm. And so attorneys can also kind of discuss what's happening in criminal or penal settings for people who are doing Bitcoin-related things and also defend them. But I'm just like, what can attorneys build on Bitcoin? And then the broader question, you know, what can anybody with their own particular professional or non-professional skill set build with Bitcoin? It's just a fascinating thing.
One of the things that I think about, like, I mean, you're in an apartment, you had to put a security deposit down. There is often a problem, especially in like college towns, where you see lessors, the people that are renting out the property, they're often very heavy-handed with the security deposit, and people find themselves being taken advantage of because they're a college student. They don't have the funds to dispute that, oh, this, you know, this mark that I left on the wall, you know, I'm going to lose my entire security deposit, you know, $1,500 or something because of that. And that's like an area where I could see this really being useful with this community resolution, much like the bounty system proposal where, you know, you enter into the contract, you put your security deposit, not in your renters or in the lessor's name, but you put it into a time locked, two-party system. And then if there is a dispute at the end of it, then the evidence is submitted by both parties. And then you have people that are voting whether or not, the owner deserves to get the security deposit or the person deserves to get it back. That's one that having lived in a couple of college towns and I used to finance some people that owned a lot of properties, and I saw up front that it was not, it's a moral hazard. It is really just the problem. It's not like the people are bad. It's just that, look, if somebody's already given you the money, then you're probably not going to give it back unless there's a really good reason. And so they look for reasons to keep it. That's one. I'm trying to think of how can Bitcoin play a role in murder trials? And
So you, at the start of this, you'll note that Daniel says, he begins talking about civil court judgments. And so
that's the easiest one, right? Yeah. Right. Because it doesn't require coercion, right? Where it's just like,
yeah, control of flow of funds usually is sufficient to resolve a civil case. Like someone's got to pay somebody else. Yeah. And he notes too that the MJRGA model is based on not on retributive justice, but in like compensating parties. So retributive justice is like, there's no, in some situations, there's no amount you can pay somebody. An eye for an eye needs to happen between the parties to restore some sense of moral equilibrium. Like you just have to put the person in a cage. They have to physically suffer. Maybe the death penalty is merited, right? Yeah.
The MJRGA one, I think, is interesting because he notes that it hasn't worked. Right. The mobile JIRGA thing hasn't been taken. And when I was reading it, so the way that it exists right now is what they do is they get together a group of elders. And if it's like from two different tribes, they get, you know, six elders from here, six elders from there. They go meet under a tree. Somebody supplies a bar, and it makes me laugh. It makes me think of, you know, we're both from Western Kansas, and the standard unit of account for any sort of volunteer work is a steak dinner. Yeah. and people love their steak dinner.
A pack of beer that you'll leave that behind.
Yeah. Or a 30 pack. Yeah. Yeah, and so they're not going to let that go easily. And I was wondering, I was like, dude, you just need to throw a steak dinner on top of this M. Jurga thing.
It's interesting when you're describing, you say they meet in front of a tree, and that's one of the details they mentioned in this article. And that's what, like, it's not ridiculous to say that, because when I was reading this M. Jurga and they were talking about how they wanted to make this Jurga embodied system face to face into a mobile thing, I immediately became skeptical because it's all of the rich tradition of this face to face encounter. The system kind of works based on shame parties that the elders have rendered a result. I'm going to abide by it because if I don't, the people know that I'm disobeying the elders. But if it's this abstract system and then I could see how that system would lose. But again, this is every community with a Fedimint model around the world in which Bitcoin funds are controlled locally. They can, according to their own norms and customs, try to design some sort of ODR system, maybe with the face-to-face element somehow, however, that abides by their norms, right? Everybody can like iterate and you don't have to have a one-size-fits-all type thing.
That was an interesting one, this community thing that he proposed, where, say you have the little town that I grew up in, a couple thousand people, and in order to be a citizen of that town, you would have to put up a certain amount of money that is kept within the Fedimint system of that town, in order to ensure that if there is some sort of dispute, that you have the funds that are available to pay if you're found liable. And I think you look at these little towns, most of these people bank in community banks. It's no different than that. It's just that it would be under one umbrella instead of 8 or 10, and it would be enforceable through consent. Which I like that idea. The thing that I wonder about is, like, how much money would you have to put in? Like, it may be like, because you think about, like, it may be a significant amount that you would need to keep as a balance in there, because of, what if I burn your house down? Right.
But like as your risk profile declines over time, as you get older, maybe you post a bond in Bitcoin, that Bitcoin appreciates over time, and then suddenly you built in a social security mechanism from that initial bond amount because it pays out in your later years just on a like a time locked or whatever manner where it's like you get distributions every year from it because it's appreciated so much over 40 years, you can now retire on the initial bond you posted to participate in civil society or whatever.
You would want more for the old people because they're the ones that always drive through the wall.
That aspect, I said lower risk profile, but there is a certain people could then, maybe they would be more cautious about modifying their own risky behaviors if they're like, oh, I've already posted this cash amount that I can get back if I don't do something very stupid.
Because then it's like, it removes a step. It removes a step where it's like, oh, not only do I have to get caught, I also have to get coerced into paying. It's like, no, now I just need to get caught. Because if I screw up, then my money is.
This brings up one aspect of the article that kind of concerned me. Not in the article, but this whole notion. I mean, like, maybe it becomes easier to impose like a social credit system once you're. I mean, the thing is, you've consented to enter into the system, but if the system is big enough where exit becomes difficult, like if we first the communities, Norton, Kansas, then it's Kansas, then it's the United States, then it's the Western Hemisphere that are within the same system or something. You post an amount of money, suddenly you're locked in, and they can impose automatic debits from that if it's not constructed well. I mean, Bitcoin is resistant to that because you can construct the arrangement to be separate apart from that with the external party, third party not having control. But if it's designed ex ante from the ground up with a third party having control, they can also do that.
There's it's so interesting to see how those systems work, because you think about, like, London, which has, I think, more security cameras than any place in the world, and San Francisco, which is very heavily surveilled, Washington, D.C., very heavily surveilled. These are really dangerous places to be. Like, these are among the most dangerous places in the world for physical violence. But you can definitely get caught for walking across the street. And so you put these systems in, you're right. It creates that moral hazard that allows for the nitpicking and the nickel and diming of parking violations and jaywalking and this, that, and the other. But in practice, it doesn't seem to be breaking down the violence and the actual, yeah. So.
Bitcoin allows you, if you start off with the right principles, to build a system that doesn't allow for a third party to control it. And that's the beauty of it. You don't have like Ethereum, you can build on that. At the end of the day, there's always a third party risk. If you build on Bitcoin, you can build something resilient to a state later coming in and say, we want to impose our own social credit aspect on top of it.
Yeah, that's what we need. Is we need a group that votes on it. When they see me jaywalk and they review the video and they're like, he walked across and there was no cars coming. It was just red and he just had shit to do and he had a place to go. We'd be like, fine, we'll let that guy. But if you got the guy that walks out into traffic and causes an accident, maybe we can find that guy. We can determine that crowdsourced from bottom up in a way that it's... Fairness is something that is, I think, less important than usefulness and common sense. Like, you know, you walk across an empty street that has a red light, fine. Like, it's not fair because you're doing the thing that is supposedly against the law, but it's stupid.
Well, it just comes down to community norms. Like, yeah. I've heard if you have a Japanese person, they're never going to cross when there's not a walk sign blinking. Like, their notion of jaywalking is just very culturally embedded that you don't do that, and there's social coercion if you do that. Whereas other cultures are much more open with, it's okay, you know, to walk in a situation. And neither one is absolutely correct or incorrect. It's just, again, every community can build their system according to their norms.
That is a very American thesis that I'm proposing, which is basically like, I'm just going to do what I want up until the point that it affects somebody else. You know, the right to swing my fist stands where the person's nose begins and all. Yeah.
Yeah.
I like it.
For an ODR system to function, I'm just going to give a broad concluding summary. For an ODR system to function, it needs to have control of the flow funds, and you need to have a community in which it can be embedded so people actually use it. A BDR system can conceptually achieve both. That community is also worldwide, so we can begin to patchwork implement this wherever you are. And BDR then could be a way in which the uncorded or corded, right? Is that the... we court the uncorded.
Coerced.
Corded by coercion.
I think you're just making up words now. Court. Yeah, that's fine. So.
Yeah. Yeah. So what we found through this discussion is that Bitcoin does hold the technological ability to export a fair and just legal system to places where it's not domestically available. And I think we also have uncovered that it's not really domestically available anywhere, that even in the country, the United States, that supposedly has the best legal system in the world, we still have a two-tiered legal system. We still have opportunities for injustices. And so I think it can make everything better for everyone.
Like, you can always improve access to justice. The court system in the United States is notorious for various things. I mean, it can be expensive. You got to lawyer up, and it's adversarial, which is not good in some situations. So, yeah.
Yeah. All right.
All right. Well, we're going to take this
out.
That's
all I got. Yeah.
All right. Guys, thank you for joining us. Once again, we are reviewing the Satoshi Papers by Natalie Smolinski. Very much encourage you to take a read. And if you'd like to, please view our videos that are online that can go as a companion with these. Thank you to W. Aaron Daniel Esquire for fantastic work. Thank you to Grant for our first in-person ability to discuss these things. And as always, please, if you find value in this, share it with your friends and consider us yours. We're all in this together. So have a good one.